From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Today is officially the first day of summer. We made it. Time to go fishing, get in the woods, get in the water, relax. Time for a lot of people for a special kind of reading, summer reading. What to read this summer? We're on it. This hour On Point, great summer reads for 2013. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's on your short list this summer? What are you reading, recommending, looking for? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We have great readers with us today, and I'm sure, some great recommendations. With us from Wichita, Kansas, is Sarah Bagby, owner of Watermark Books, an independent bookstore in Wichita. She's also on the board of directors of the American Booksellers Association. Sarah Bagby, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
It's wonderful.
Thank you for asking.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you. How's the weather in Wichita?
Not bad for the first day of summer. Okay. I think it's going to be a pretty nice day.
I remember driving through years ago and my Legos melted onto the back window of the car when my dad was driving. From Seattle, Washington, Marianne Gwynn is here, longtime book critic for the Seattle Times, co-host of American Public Television's Well Read. Marianne Gwynn, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
Jessica Donahue joins us in a moment. And you can find all of my guests' summer recommendations and a running list of our listeners' picks at our website, onpointradio.org. We have lots of recommendations flowing in from listeners all over the country and the world. And I think we've got Jessica now from San Francisco. Jessica Donahue's here, features editor at Goodreads.com, the world's largest online site for readers and book recommendations. Jessica Donahue, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Thomas. Good to be here.
Wonderful to have you. Thanks, all three, for being here. So I'm looking at your list in front of me right now. They're up at our website, listeners, if you want to go and see each and every recommendation of this great gang. Marianne Gwynn, begin to take us in here. What do you like? Give us a few, a couple of three that you like.
Well, I really love a great nonfiction book. My training is as a journalist, and if it's a great story and it's based on the truth, that just, you know, that's kind of a double charge for me.
Yeah.
I'm going to mention a couple of books that are great nonfiction tales. The first one is a homegrown Seattle story called The Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans and Their Epic Quest for Gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics by Daniel James Brown. As you probably recall, the 1936 Berlin Olympics were basically held by the Nazis as kind of a propaganda stunt.
Mm-hmm, famously.
And this is a story of a very homegrown University of Washington crew team, what they called an eight-oar team. It was in the depths of the Depression. Most of the guys on the team, you know, didn't have 2 cents to rub together, particularly the head of the crew named Joe Gantz.
And these are not fancy boys. These were farm boys.
Right. And not only did they vanquish all the Ivy teams, which, you know, crew is a big Ivy sport, they went to Berlin and they won right before Leni Riefenstahl's cameras. And it is such a great story, not just, you know, it's a heroic story, but it's not an individual hero. It's eight boys working together, in some ways subsuming their egos, because that's what you have to do with crew.
The Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans and Their Epic Quest for Gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. That's by Daniel James Brown. Hold the thought right there. Let me get one from Jessica, if I may. Jessica, give us a top pick or two.
Sure. You know, when I was thinking about what books to suggest, I took a look at what readers are recommending on Goodreads and really searched for books that are getting glowing reviews and that people just can't seem to stop talking about them and wanting to tell their friends about it. And one of the books that's, I think, going to be one of the big books of the summer, it's not out yet. It's coming in August, and it already has a lot of people talking about it. It's called Night Film by Marisha Pessel. And she was known a few years back. She wrote special topics in calamity physics.
Yes.
And her new book is a psychological thriller. And I got to say, I finished it just this week. I was lucky enough to get an early copy, and I can't think of the last time I stayed up so late reading, trying to finish a book, and scaring myself half to death. Honest to goodness, throat clenching fear while reading this book.
This is a horror film, but set what in a world of a horror book set in a world of film.
Well, it's about an investigative journalist, and he has kind of made it his life's work in a way to investigate the work of a reclusive, very famous, idiosyncratic film director. And the film director, his films are horror films. People who watch his films say that they change, that's a life-changing experience. And
horror films in which his own daughter, very young, stars. Talk about creepy.
And at the beginning of the book, what we learn is that that daughter, who's now a young woman, has committed suicide. And our hero, this journalist, he has this hunch that something's not right. He doesn't quite buy that it was a suicide, and he starts hunting down clues, and he just goes down this rabbit hole. And it's a wild ride. And I actually have an excerpt here if you'd like to hear it.
Yes, please read a little from this is Night Film by Marisha Pessel. If you want it for summer reading, you'll have to wait until August from Random House. But here it is. Here's a little read.
So this is just from the book's prologue. The narrator, he has insomnia, and he's running laps around the reservoir in Central Park at 2 a.m., and he thinks a woman in a red coat is following him. The night fell unnaturally silent, still. That mist, it had moved beyond the water into the trees, overtaken the track like a sickness, an exhaust off something in the air here, something malignant. Another minute and I was approaching the north gatehouse. I shot past it, expecting to see her on the landing. It was deserted. There was no sign of her anywhere. Yet the longer I ran, the path unspooling like an underpass to some dark new dimension in front of me, the more I found the encounter unfinished. A song that had cut out on an expectant note, the film projector sputtering to a halt seconds before a pivotal chase scene, the screen going white. I couldn't shake the powerful feeling that she was very much here, hiding somewhere, watching me.
Ooh, dark new dimension. We've got it right there in Night Film. We'll look for that later in the summer. Sarah Bagby, you've got a couple on here from Ruth Ozeki. Remind us about her and what you're recommending this summer from Ruth.
Okay, well, her first novel that I read, My Year of Meats, was at the time cutting edge. It was told through a series of facts and email and film clips, and it explored the popular culture of meat and the way it was sold in the United States, contrasted with a Japanese housewife for whom propaganda films were made in order to sell them meat and have an American lifestyle. And through this sort of communication, an American woman and a Japanese woman become friends and help each other through, you know, their contemporary lives full of challenges and issues. And it is an inventive, amazing novel that has changed so many lives that I can't recommend it enough. And her new one, A Tale for the Time Being, is also contrasts two people. One is a writer with writer's block in the Pacific Northwest, and the other one is a young girl in Japan who has just moved there from Sunnydale, California, because her father lost his job in the Silicon Valley. Once she gets to her new home, she's bullied relentlessly because she's bigger, she's different, she hasn't grown up with all these other kids. She's just bullied relentlessly. Her father doesn't have a job. He's distraught. And so he decides to read the Great Minds of Western Philosophy, which they have on the shelf because in the United States, his wife had worked for a publishing company that published these. So the beautiful and so creative thing that Ruth Ozeki does is combines these deep issues with popular culture. And so the voice is very contemporary, yet very smart and engaging. So it appeals to all these senses that we have. The other thing about Ruth is that she became a Buddhist priest over the last 10 years. And so she infuses a lot of Zen Buddhism into this novel. And it ends up, these systems of religion end up sort of saving everyone, because what we have in the end is ourselves and our habits and our the way we approach life individually.
A Tale for the
and
Time
And I do have an
being.
Excerpt.
I don't know if we have time to read it before the break. Is Ruth Ozeki okay. Japanese, Japanese-American? Does she have a family history in Japan?
She's Japanese-American. Her, yes, she's Japanese-American, but she grew up in New Haven, Connecticut.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about great summer reads with Marianne Gwynn of the Seattle Times, Sarah Bagby of Watermark Books in Wichita, Kansas, and Jessica Donaghy joins us from San Francisco today. She's features editor at goodreads.com, big site for book recommendations. All of their picks are up at our website, onpointradio.org, and there are a lot of your suggestions there as well already. Check them out. Bring Up the Bodies, Hilary Mantel's book, made it on Marianne Gwynn's list out of Seattle there. Hilary Mantel was with us not so long ago, and she read a little bit from her latest, Bring Up the Bodies. Here's Hilary Mantel.
Thomas Cromwell's now about 50 years old. He has a laborer's body, stocky, youthful, running to fat. He has black hair, graying now. And because of his pale, impermeable skin, which seems designed to resist rain as well as sun, people sneer that his father was an Irishman. Though really, he was a brewer and a blacksmith at Putney, a man with a finger in every pie, a scrapper and a brawler, a drunk and a bully.
Hilary Mantel reading there for us at On Point from Bring Up the Bodies. Marianne, she has come out with some great ones, and a lot of people still reading this with great joy. Can you jump in anywhere? Do you have to go all the way back to Wolf Hall to begin?
You know, Tom, I would. This is such an epic, and it will just consume you. I mean, she takes the character of Thomas Cromwell, who was sort of Henry VIII's fixer, right-hand man, henchman, and she just fills out his backstory as she was reading, and boy, does she have a wonderful voice. Thomas Cromwell was basically a common man who rose to the highest levels of Henry VIII's court, engineered all kinds of political coups. But what Hilary Mantel does in a way that I have never experienced from any other writer is she just plumps you down in that time, and you feel like you are living and you're breathing it. And Wolf Hall is the first installment. Bring Up the Bodies is the second one, in which Anne Boleyn is becoming a liability to Henry, and Cromwell has to work to get rid of her. And it is just suspenseful and riveting and great literature.
I've got people responding online here. Gustavo says, liked Khalid Hosseini's new book, And the Mountains Echoed. Already started. It's so good. I want to read it slowly to enjoy it over a longer period of time. That's a summer sensation. Amy writes to us, I recently finished Flight Behavior by Barbara Kingsolver. I have two more books of hers on her nightstand pile. Also reading Mary Kay Andrews' Ladies Night. Delightfully fun. Great summer read. James says, I have two small children. Just reading a book would be great, but not so easy when it goes that way. Sarah, what about the latest from Hosseini? He's of course famous for his books with an Afghanistan setting. What about the latest?
Well, the latest is a little bit of a departure for Khalid Hosseini. He tells a story that is set, it begins in Afghanistan. It's set also in Paris, Greece, and San Francisco, Northern California. It is a book that where the politics are more off the page and individual lives there are stories of individual lives in the back, and in the background is, you know, political upheaval and the history of the politics in Afghanistan. It opens with an incredibly moving fable in which a father has to sacrifice one of his children to save the rest of them. And he's eventually given something to erase his memory so that he can forget about this child that he sacrificed in order to just sort of live his life. Anyway, that sort of sets the themes of the book, that fable. And of course, in the book, it opens with a family who have to sort of give up a child. And from there, the events just expand. And the characters, there's a narrative through the whole book that sort of ties up at the end, of course. But the individual stories of these myriad characters from all over the world, some doctors, a poet, a rich Afghan businessman, nurses and doctors in hospitals. It's just an amazing hit. Khaled's ability to tell a story just is gripping. And it's a book that you have to read slowly. I tore through it the first time, just wanting to know what was going to happen. And when I went back and read it slowly, it was amazing how many passages I highlighted, how many things. I mean, he just grabs your heart and has so much empathy for every character that you see so much in these characters. And it's just an amazing book.
Khaled Hosseini with his latest. I understand he was in Wichita the other night and had 800 people come out. He can really pull an audience, that guy.
Yes, he can. And he was an amazing, he was generous and just an amazing speaker.
Marianne,
connected with every single person.
Let me go to another one in your backyard, Marianne. The Orchardist by Amanda Copeland? I'm not sure. Introduce
it's
us to
Copeland
this.
And, Copeland. And boy, I just wish everybody would read this book.
Orchardist as in orchard. Orchardist. Right. What's it about? And maybe give us a read.
I would love to do that. It's set in Central Eastern Washington around the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th. And that area, before the advent of irrigation, was pretty dry, very sunny, very, very rural. And a lot of people made their living by growing fruits, hence the title, The Orchardist.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a very solitary man named Talmage, whose only family member has died, so he doesn't have any connections other than one friend. And he, two runaway girls stumble onto his property. They are both pregnant. They're sisters. They have been sexually abused. And he ends up taking care of them, and they become his family. And the excerpt I would like to read would be, these girls have been living in the wild, in the property, around
Della,
the property.
Della and Jane, the two.
Right. Mm-hmm. And this is the moment when they decide to trust Talmage after having been terribly abused by other men. They rose one morning in the orchard, and it was humid and cool, and the sky overhead was dark gray. They rose when the first raindrops hit their faces. They did not discuss what they were doing, but crossed the yard and hesitated only briefly before going onto the porch. Jane's brow furrowed. The door was open. There were two birchwood chairs on the porch, but when Della went to sit in one, Jane grunted and motioned that they should not sit there. The man, when he came to stand in the doorway, found them sitting with their backs to him, legs dangling off the side of the porch. Della turned to look over her shoulder at him, but Jane told her in a low voice to turn around. That morning, two of them ate on the porch while the rain poured down a foot from their knees, and behind them, inside the cabin, the man sat in the chair on the corner drinking coffee. Della could smell it and reading a newspaper. Jane had thought that if there were ever a moment that presented itself for him to forget his manners and take advantage of them, then that moment on the porch, in the rainstorm, was it. But he did not even sit outside with him. He waited indoors until the rain stopped, and then a few minutes later, the sun showing palely through the breaking clouds, he passed by them and walked across the grass and into the orchard.
There from The Orchardist by Amanda Copeland. In the great Northwest, orchards of plum and apricot and apples and mercy, as it turns out. And that,
yes, and very young author, her first novel. It's quite wonderful.
Highly recommended there by Marianne Gwynn of the Seattle Times. We have so many callers, some from that neck of the woods. Barry in Blackfoot, Idaho. Thanks for calling, Barry. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What are you reading?
Well, right now, I personally am reading Victor Hugo's Les Mis.
You're going big.
Yeah, I read the abridged version 6 or 7 years ago, and now that I'm reading the unabridged version, I can't tell. Like I have no idea how they left anything out.
Right.
But along with that, our family reads every night. I've got four kids, and we take turns picking what book we're going to read.
Yeah.
And right now, it's my 8-year-old daughter's pick, and we're reading Jane Eyre.
Oh, how wonderful. You've got good readers. Are they gripped?
Well, yeah. It's a plus. It helps. We her name is Adele, which is the name of the
right. But does your 8-year-old follow the love story here? Can she go with that?
Just met Mr. Rochester last night.
Yes.
So we're getting there. But yeah, I mean we've read Lord of the Rings, we've read 7 years in Tibet, we've read all kinds of things with them. So
you are major league readers in Blackfoot, Idaho. We'll think of you with Les Mis and the whole family with Jane Eyre. Barry, I so appreciate your call. Happy reading this summer to you. Angela in Nashville, Tennessee. Angela, thanks. What are you reading?
Hi, Tom. Hi. I actually read this book, and I loved it. It's called I Do Not Come to You by Chance by Nwabani. It tells the story of how a young man that, you know, comes from a decent background, you know, with his parents in Nigeria.
Uh-huh.
He graduates from college, becomes an engineer, is unable to get a job, and it just shows you step by step how he gradually becomes a scam artist. And it's really interesting, you know, like he's unable to get a job and he is in like several unfortunate circumstances. And then in the end, he says he never wanted to do this, but in the end, he says he has to do this to support his family. And, you know, it's really bad. It's a bad thing, but it just somehow makes the character, you kind of feel sorry for the character.
That's great, that experience of earning or gaining empathy for somebody in a very different setting, Angela.
Yes, this is somebody that is doing something very bad. He's basically stealing money, savings, like people
right.
are giving him all his savings and
yeah.
he's taking it, and then you kind of feel sorry because, you know, his circumstances. Terrible.
Angela, we've got it, and thanks for that little mini trip into the Nigerian reality there. I Did Not Come to You by Chance by, I think it's Tricia Nwabani. One more here. Lindsay in Charleston, South Carolina. What are you reading, Lindsay?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am reading Journey by Starlight. It's actually a graphic novel by Ian Flitcroft
okay. And
illustrated by Britt Spencer. It's kind of like Einstein takes you on a journey on a beam of light. It's all things science. Explains the origins of the universe, the meaning of life, relativity, black holes, quantum mechanics, how the brain works. I would have loved finding something like this when I was in high school, when I was a kid. But even as an adult, it's got such fun, amazing illustrations. It's just been really fun to read.
Einstein. That's great. Who better to travel with? Anywhere, I guess. Einstein, Journey by Starlight by Ian Flitcroft. We're looking at great reads, summer reads for 2013. Sarah Bagby in Wichita, I wonder if you'd introduce us to Sisterland from Curtis Sittenfeld.
Okay. Curtis Sittenfeld, this book should be out any day now. I think it may be next week. But
mm-hmm.
Curtis Sittenfeld is an amazing writer, novelist who lives in St. Louis, and this Sisterland is set in St. Louis. It's about identical twin sisters. They have a sign on their door in their house as they're growing up. That says Sisterland. And so that is sort of emblematic of how close they are, the proximity to each other, you know, the trajectory of their lives. They have a hard time coming apart. But as they grow older, they do need to find their own way. As children, they had these powers of ESP. And in their adulthood, one of them embraces that ESP and is seduced by morning TV to come on and share her prediction of an earthquake that's going to hit St. Louis.
Oh, boy.
It sounds very unbelievable, but the way that Curtis can tell this story is amazing. Meanwhile, her sister is living in a suburb of St. Louis. Her husband is a professor at Washington University, and she's a stay-at-home mom. Her best friend is a stay-at-home dad. And, of course, they know more about each other's marriages than they probably should. Not that that's any kind of problem, but it's just that way that we become intimate with other people in our daily lives.
Sarah, dive right in and read for us, if you would, a little bit from Sister
Matt. I would love to. Okay, let me just set this up for 1 second.
Quickly, we're up against a break here.
Okay, this is a memory from one of the sisters, and the mother was hard. Why did my mother make things hard when they didn't have to be? That's the main question I ask myself in retrospect. Our lives weren't glamorous, but they weren't so bad, either. They were ordinary. And there are many worse ways to be. Though looking back, I see my father's complicity, too. If I were to fault him for falling for my mother, I'd be wishing away my own existence. But I was fairly sure he proposed to my mother, perhaps without really ever knowing her, for a foolish if time-honored reason, which was that she was beautiful. In photographs from around that time, they married, her straight blonde hair is parted in the center and falls past her shoulders. Her lips are thin but flirtatiously upturned. Her cheekbones are high, her eyes big and blue, her lashes accentuated with carefully applied mascara. She was 5'5", the same height as Vi and I eventually grew to. But outside of pregnancy, I don't think she ever weighed more than 110 pounds. She favored snug blouses, dresses that cinched her small waist, jumpsuits with flared pants. In a photo Vi and I especially liked, our mother stands in front of the arch, holding our father's hand. She wears a belted orange wool jacket with an oversized collar and a matching orange beret. He has dark sideburns. Both of our parents are beaming.
Sarah Bagby reading there from Curtis Sittenfeld's Sisterland. Sarah, will our listeners in St. Louis like this book?
Oh, I think so. Absolutely. She, Curtis is, gets every detail correct. When she says that her mother's standing in front of the arch, it's the famous, you know, arch that sort of defines St. Louis. And it's, and there are lots of scenes that happen there as you see time pass. The two sisters, when they're graduating from high school at 4 o'clock in the morning, go to the arch and look up at the lay down underneath it and look up at the stars and speculate on the future and remember the past, and the neighborhoods are very well drawn. One of the things that Curtis is so good at is taking these details from our lives and making them profound.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about great summer reads 2013, from Ireland to Northwest Orchards to Maine to Monte Cristo to Dante's Inferno again. And let me tell you, at our website, at our Facebook page, on Twitter, there is a superabundance of recommendations from our listeners, and I really hope you will check them out. We also have the full list of recommendations from each of my three guests this hour: Sarah Bagby of Watermark Books in Wichita, Kansas, Marianne Gwynn, book critic for the Seattle Times, and Jessica Donaghy, features editor at Goodreads.com, where an awful lot of people also leave recommendations. You can join us, 800-423-TALK. Jessica Donaghy in San Francisco, tell us about Transatlantic, this Cullum McCann book that's getting a lot of attention. Settings, what, all over the place in time and space. Tell us about it, Jessica.
Cullum is calling this book his most Irish novel to date, which is fun. He's, of course, known for Let the Great World Spin, his book from 2009. It won the National Book Award and was very much immersed in New York City. And this new book he's calling his most Irish book. So it's historical fiction, and it weaves together several different stories. And at its core, it's telling the story of four generations of women who were descended from an Irish housemaid in the 1800s. And these women, their lives intersect with real men from history. And these men are all men who made significant transatlantic crossings. So we have Frederick Douglass, the abolitionist, who visited Ireland in 1845. We have the first nonstop flight made by the famous aviators Jack Alcock and Arthur Brown. They flew across for the first time over the ocean in 1919. And then he also writes about Senator George Mitchell, who, of course, was a big part of brokering the peace in Northern Ireland in the late 90s. And one of the things Cullum McCann has said about this book is he says, I wanted to write about peace, And he said, I think waging peace is so much more difficult than waging war. And I just love that idea. And he just really connects these stories across about 150 years of history and is talking about these characters' place in history.
Very ambitious there, Cullen McCann's yes. Transatlantic. Could you read a little bit for us, paragraph two?
Sure. So this is, in this passage, the aviators, Alcock and Brown, they're making the historic flight over the Atlantic Ocean.
This is 1919, British veterans of Vickers Vimy from Newfoundland to Ireland.
And it describes what it's like to fly this tiny plane, a two-man plane, for such a distance. Floating icebergs below, the roughly furrowed sea, they know there will be no turning back. It's all mathematics now. To convert the fuel into time and distance, to set the throttle for the optimum burn, to know the angles and the edges and the spaces in between. The noise rolls through their bodies. At times they make a music of it, a rhythm that conducts itself from head to chest to toes, but then they are lifted from the rhythm and it becomes pure noise again. They are well aware that they could go deaf on the flight and that the roar could lodge itself inside them forever, their bodies carrying it like human gramophones, so that if they ever make it to the other side, they will still, always, somehow hear it.
Wow, that's just great. What great phrases in there. And to set the throttle for the optimum burn, always a big question in life. That's
we
wonderful.
No longer think of flying planes as taking physical strength, and yet for them it was a true feat that they were able to withstand the conditions that they did.
First Atlantic crossing there. A couple of trends in self-published books and audiobooks that you've been following, Jessica. Tell us.
Well, one of the big trends we've been noticing on Goodreads is the explosion of romance. And this is especially good if you're looking for some juicy summer reading. Of course, the big media story last year was 50 Shades of Grey, and there's certainly been an after effect since then, and a lot of writers jumping into the romance space. And
is that what we call romance now? Is 50 Shades of Grey romance, the tie me up, tie me down? Is it the same kind of erotically charged romance that people are writing in on?
I think erotica specifically as a subset of romance has certainly seen a growth in its readership.
Sure.
And one of the big authors in that space specifically has been Sylvia Day. And her latest book in the Crossfire series, it's called Entwined with You. And she just announced this week that she sold more than 550,000 copies in the U.S. alone just in the first week of this book being published.
Holy smokes. Wow.
I was looking at how readers were adding it on Goodreads, and one of the fun things about the stats that was unique was that they were adding it to their shelf on Goodreads and then reading it right away. Usually when a book comes out, you see people adding it and then the growth of people actually finishing it and writing the reviews. That's a little bit more of a slow burn. But for this, day one, they got the book. They couldn't wait. They read it and immediately wanted to get on Goodreads and write the reviews and talk about it with their friends. So very passionate reader set who have just embraced this erotica genre.
Sylvia Day with Entwined with You. Sounds like it right there. Marianne Gwynn, you've got Louise Erdich back in fine form with The Roundhouse. Of course, she's had lots of wonderful novels with a Native American backdrop to them. What about The Roundhouse?
Well, The Roundhouse is it's set in the 1980s on a North Dakota Indian reservation. And if you're familiar with Louise Erdrich's novels, they're the same characters or their sons or their grandchildren or their grandfathers or grandmothers. They're entire generations that go across the novels. This particular one concerns Geraldine Kautz, who is a woman who works in the tribal records office of her North Dakota reservation. She's married to a tribal judge. She goes to the office one day, and she's viciously assaulted. She's raped. And the rest of the book relates the father's and the son's attempt to find out who did it and what it does to the family. It is a a terrific book, very hard material, but Louise Erdrich is such a magical writer. It also has, you know, humor and vivid descriptions. It's great, and it won the National Book Award for Fiction this past year, deservedly so.
You've got a little snippet of a read from The Roundhouse. Could you share it?
Yes, this is right from the beginning, and it and her son is the narrator of the book. This is him speaking. Mm-hmm. Women don't realize how much store men set on the regularity of their habits. We absorb their comings and goings into our bodies, their rhythms into our bones. Our pulse is set to theirs. And as always, on a weekend afternoon, we were waiting for my mother to start us ticking away on the evening. Her absence stopped time.
Ah, beautiful. Louise Erdrich, she just delivers, and you say delivers very big this time. Sarah, you've got one called Pure. Puts us in, what, Paris, just before the revolution. What's the story?
Well, Pure is it is a wonderful book about an engineer. He's very ambitious, and he's been charged to empty Les Innocents Cemetery, which is sort of spewing out of itself because so many bodies were put in it during the plague. And it's sort of a metaphor for the contemporary life in Paris at that time, you know, this just spilling out of refuse and
they're hiring miners to dig up thousands of bodies and cart away the bones.
The miners come in, and so there's this combination of the miners working of having to shore up the sides of the earth and the ground so that it doesn't implode on them, and yet also just this dissemination of all this, you know, land and these bodies. And so it's this very, you know, he keeps just juxtaposing stability and instability. And then also, you know, and the characters that come in and out. It's a very, very eloquently told story about a class and a country that is just under siege by itself and on the verge of something big. And it's a great historical novel that came out in 2012.
After Les Mis out in Blackfoot, Idaho, it sounds like this might be a good one. I mean, they've even got their mistress, prostitute, all the rest here. Marianne, you've got another out of Paris. That was Pure by Andrew Miller. Marianne, you've got The Black Count, Glory, Revolution, Betrayal, and The Real Count of Monte Cristo by Tom Rees, I guess. What's the story?
Man, what a story. I can't believe nobody's ever written this story before. This is the story of General Alex Dumas, the son, the father of the author of The Count of Monte Cristo.
And The Three Musketeers and so on.
And The Three Musketeers, yes. Okay. And it turns out that Alex was the son of a slave from Haiti. He was a black man. He rose to the top of Napoleon's military empire, commanded 50,000 soldiers, and then he got on the wrong side of Napoleon, and Napoleon did his best to erase all memory of this man, and to the point that the author's attempts to even find out anything about Alex are quite amusing.
So this is the father of the author of The Count of Monte Cristo and the author of The Three Musketeers, and it turns out that the model for that count is his own father, born in Haiti, 1762, becomes a huge general, and then what sort of erased by Napoleon. Can you see the outline of the Count of Monte Cristo story in his father's life, Marianne?
Oh, very much so. And one thing that Tom Rees talks about is how the theme of people going missing and being erased from memory is such a theme in the son's books. I mean, you know, people disappear into prison for years on end. And that is exactly what happened to his father.
I did not know the whole racial Haitian angle on this family story, but it's very well told here, I guess.
Yes, it won the Pulitzer for biography this past year, and a great story.
The Black Count by Tom Rees. We're looking at great summer reads for 2013. Let's go to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Scott. Hi, Scott. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Very well. What are you reading?
Well, I'm getting ready to reread House of Leaves by Mark Daniel Zuski.
Okay. Tell us about it.
It is a particularly unique book. It's kind of a thriller, but it's a read that's been able to draw me in more than, you know, or make me part of the story almost. And that it's sort of a, you could almost describe it as a telescoping or a nesting doll kind of thing. You're reading about a guy who's reading about a journal of this house, of people exploring this house.
Yeah.
And it's bigger on the inside than it should be on the outside. And it's the suspense in it and the, I mean, it's just so unique. The first page, you open the book and it says, "This is not for you." And you kind of think, well, you know, what's that about?
Oh, right.
And as you go along, you just feel like someone's watching you. Like the guy who's reading the journal, is weird things start happening to him. And this exploration team that he's reading about is going into these deep, dark caves inside the house in hallways that are longer than they should be. And it just is one of the most unique books I've ever read.
You've definitely got my attention, Scott. I mean, it sounds like what this is, House of Leaves, Mark Daniel Zuski, bigger on the inside than the outside. Sounds like books themselves. I love that. Thank you, Scott. In Tulsa, one more here from New Orleans. Jonas, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to talk about Walter Munch's In the Blink of an Eye.
Okay.
A real good book about editing, you know?
Yes, I've heard of it, but I haven't read it. How does he make editing a thrilling experience?
Well, because I know, like, right now they have a lot of people, you know, with the proliferation of the digital tools, a lot of people have access to editing equipment, but they don't have a lot of the theory behind it.
Are you talking text editing or video editing?
I'm talking video editing.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, and, you know, I think it's just a great book for anybody that wants to, you know, become an artist or, you know, hone their craft.
Yeah, stop time, think about those images, how they work together. I can imagine how deep you could go with that. Jonas, I appreciate your call from New Orleans. One more here from Carlisle, Massachusetts. Nancy's calling. Nancy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm on a library committee that picks one book for our town to read in the winter, and we do programs about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to recommend two of the books that are on our final list. One is American Nations by Colin Woodard, which not too many people have heard about, but all the members of the committee really loved it. It's a kind of reinterpretation of American history, and people said things like every page I said, aha, and people said, oh my God, there were light bulbs going off in my brain. But it, despite the fact that it has a pretty serious theme, it's pretty entertaining to read, and it's not long. And the other one that a lot of us liked is Double Cross by Ben McIntyre.
It's a Nazi setting?
Yes, it's there was the British deception of, this was a part of the British deception of the Germans that they were going to invade in Normandy. They were trying to convince them they were going to invade at Calais,
mm-hmm.
so that they wouldn't move more divisions in. And a big part of that deception was a quite large network of double agents that they had built up in Britain over the years preceding the invasion. And this is a story of the agents, the networks, and the people who ran them. And this also is extremely entertaining. It's very amusing because most of the people in the book are really kind of off the wall. A lot of them are eccentric or
right.
You know, maybe even mentally ill.
But they worked as double agents and set up success on D-Day. And Double Cross by Ben McIntyre there, and American Nations, Nancy's recommending, from Colin Woodard. Jessica, just quickly here, Willa Cather is back on the shelves with her selected letters this summer. What do you learn there, Jessica?
You know, that's something that I haven't checked into, but if you can search for the book on Goodreads, you can see what people are already saying about it.
Sarah, have you read it?
Yes, I'm reading it. Actually, I'm in the middle of it.
What is it, Maya Antonia?
566 letters, and that's only 20% of the total that Willa Cather wrote.
Willa Cather out there.
She's...
And if I may, Dante's Inferno, you're taking your people into it this summer. Is it the latest translation, or where are you going there, Sarah?
It's a reprint edition of a Penguin Books translation, and we're going to
hell.
Read it together, and as we say, we're going to hell, you know, together with this book this summer.
In Wichita,
and we thought it would
Kansas.
Be fun because of Dan Brown's book.
Yeah, Dan Brown and all the rest. Sarah Bagby with Watermark Books. Marianne Gwynn at the Seattle Times. Jessica Donaghy with Goodreads.com. Thanks to each of you and all our recommendations online. Thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.